Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Who was the best professional football team in 1920? The Akron Pros? The Canton Bulldogs? Well, maybe not, because there's a team that beat both of them that was not in the APFA, the early NFL. Well, we have a historian that's going to tell us all about the Union Club of Phoenixville in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, bonus edition. It's Monday. It's pre-World War II pro football teams that are no longer with us. Maybe some you've heard of, some you haven't, and tonight might be one of those ones that you're unsure if you ever heard of before, because this is sort of a new one for me. I just heard about this team a little over a month ago at the PFRA convention from our guest host that was going to come on today to talk about his hometown team, the Union Club of Phoenixville Big Red. That's right, Scott Ferguson Green. He hails from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, which is about 26 miles outside of Philadelphia. Scott lives on the West Coast now, but he is still proud of the tradition and his town and the football team that they had over 100 years ago. Let's bring him in right now. Scott Ferguson Green, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Scott, I always like to start off a little bit. Maybe you could give our listeners just a little bit of background on how you became a great football historian and a fan of football history, and how you got interested in Phoenixville.
Well, I was born in Phoenixville, and so that is a very, very hotbed for football, has been for almost 100 years. Phoenixville basically is a town that's 23 miles northwest of Philadelphia. At the time where I was growing up, it only had like 13,000 people in it, and today, in 2021, it still only has 16,900 people living in the town. So it's a typical town that is very Americana, your small town, American town. And the one thing about it is it loves its football. And how I became very interested in football started out when I was a toddler, because just soon after I was born, maybe 6 months after I was born, my dad, who was a football coach, he was also a basketball and track coach, but he loved football. And as a football coach, he wanted me to get into the right mindset. When I was 6 months old in the cradle, he used to put a football in my cradle. And my mom used to always have to take the football out of the cradle so I could sleep. But my dad wanted me to get started in the right way. And so I just grew up on football. And my dad was a football coach. I used to go with him to the football games up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and my dad made me the manager of the football team. So my job was to make sure all the quarterbacks and wide receivers had footballs and to toss around to warm up. So even as a little tot, my dad gave me that football environment, and I just became very interested in football. And when I found out about the history of my hometown, that made me really an instant football historian.
Wow, that is very interesting. So you said Phoenixville, when you were growing up there, had about 13,000 people. Do you know about how many people they had back in the 19-teens and 1920s? Was it about the same size, you think?
It was a little less than that, but it was a vibrant town in the fact that there was a steel mill that was there, and it attracted a lot of people. And because of it, even though the population was small, a lot of people came to the town because, for example, they would always have certain festivals in the town. And, you know, because of the steel mill that was there, it was a unionized town. It was a town that people looked to as far as the steel industry, you know, in Pennsylvania.
Ah, very interesting. So the typical small town industrial setting that many pro football teams came out of back in that era. So very interesting. Now, prior to our discussion here tonight and some of the preliminary work, you told me of some famous people and some famous things that events that have happened in Phoenixville over the time. So maybe if you could share that with the listeners before we get into the football portion of it.
Right. Well, Phoenixville, Pennsylvania is a very dramatic and Irish town, and it still is. You know, there's a saying in Pennsylvania, it's almost impossible to be born in Pennsylvania without German blood flowing through your veins. And this is still true today. It's still a rather dramatic and Irish town. But
I can attest to that because I've got both of my blood and I'm from Pennsylvania, so I can attest to that.
There you go. Yeah. I have German on both sides of my family too, just because that's where I was born and raised, you know. So, but Phoenixville is known for, like I said, the Phoenix Steel Company that was there. It actually was the residence of the real Sundance Kid, Harry Lombaugh, and his family. His parents and his sister are still buried in Phoenixville in a place called Morris Cemetery. That was not that far from the town. Home where I grew up. And when Sundance and at the place, just before they went to South America, they came back to Phoenixville to visit his folks and introduce at the place to his family. And it was right after that, then they went on to New York and then sailed for South America. Phoenixville is also known for being the main location of the cult classic The Blob from 1958, starring Steve McQueen. It is also known for having the most breweries per capita in the entire United States. So you know, you can almost go anywhere and bump into a brewery in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Wow. So,
yeah. And even some of the traditions that happen there, for example, they still have the Blob Festival because of that movie, and they have a tradition called the Dogwood Festival there. And that happens every single year. And, that really celebrates all the dogwood trees that grew in the town. We had dogwood trees right in my own yard in my town of Phoenixville, right there on Maple Avenue where I grew up. But they have a dogwood festival that they celebrate every single year. It's very, like I said, a very small town Americana type town.
Okay, now you've really piqued my interest, sort of off topic, but you said they have the Blob Festival and the Dogwood Festival, two separate festivals. What kind of events happen at a Blob Festival and a Dogwood Festival?
Well, in the Blob Festival, they really celebrate the movies and celebrate the Blob. There is a theater there called the Colonial Theater that's still being used today. I used to go down to the Colonial Theater and watch Saturday matinee movies or, you know, the cartoons back then that came out of Warner Brothers. And they will all gather in front of the Colonial Theater and really celebrate the movies. You have people that will be dressed up in 50s clothes and outfits, and they make a big deal out of it. The Dogwood Festival is kind of like, almost like the Rose Festival, the Rose Parade. They have a parade there, and they have a Dogwood Queen that they don where she is selected, and she has the ladies in waiting, and it basically, in a lot of ways, it's really an excuse to really party for something that's unique to the town, and I really enjoyed both of them when I lived there.
I'll tell you what, those are truly, they got to be unique to Phoenixville, because I don't think I've ever heard of those before. Many towns have wine festivals and cherry festivals and strawberry festivals, but to have a dogwood and a blob festival, that's truly unique. So that's something special to talk about with Phoenixville.
Yeah.
Now, you were also saying maybe there was some a governor from Pennsylvania had his birthplace there. Is that true?
Correct. The governor of Pennsylvania named Samuel Pennypacker was born in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. He served in the 1800s, but the Pennypackers were a very prominent family then, and the Pennypackers still live in Phoenixville today. If you hear the name Pennypacker, it's because of Governor Samuel Pennypacker and his family. Quite a lineage of Pennypackers that continued on for generations. I actually went to school with a couple of Pennypackers when I lived in Phoenixville. So it's a name that gets instantly recognized in Southeast Pennsylvania just because of Governor Pennypacker.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, that is a very unique name there also. And there's also a very famous family, an acting family that's from there, you told me.
Yes. The families that come out of Phoenixville, the Bacons, Kevin Bacon, and his brother, Michael, still lives in Phoenixville. The Bacons actually, they used to visit their grandmother. Kevin Bacon was born in Philadelphia. Michael was born in Philadelphia, but they used to visit their grandmother who lived in Phoenixville. And I actually went to school, with their cousin, Roger Bacon. And I always remember that because Roger was actually on one of my football teams when I used to play flag football in Phoenixville. But the Bacons were very well known as far as people who went places and did things. And when Kevin Bacon started becoming a star in the movies, they still would visit their grandmother up until their grandmother passed away.
Wow, so even Scott Ferguson Green and the Union Club of Phoenixville cannot escape the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
That's correct.
Very, very interesting town indeed. I will have to make sure I stop by there. I guess you also have a famous director that's from there also.
Yes, one of the directors that came from Phoenixville is... he actually just recently won an Oscar as a producer. And the one thing that he has done is a lot of comedy movies. And he and his brother both really actually made quite a bit of money doing movies in Phoenixville. And he actually was born there. His brother was born in Providence, Rhode Island. He moved to Rhode Island a little while, and then they both went out to Hollywood to do movies. And so he and his brother really started to do a lot. But he was born in Phoenixville.
And you're talking, of course, of Peter Farrelly, correct?
Yeah, Peter Farrelly.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Very.
I should have mentioned his name. Yeah, Peter Farrelly is his name.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make sure we got that for the record here. But very interesting indeed. Okay, this makes this very intriguing to talk about the Union Club now. Well, why don't we get into that since we are a football podcast? Now, if you could tell us maybe the origins and the founders of the Union Club football team in Phoenixville.
Right. So the Union Club of Phoenixville was founded in 1907 because of the passion for football. You had townspeople who actually wanted to put together an independent football team. And the reason why they did that is because there were a lot of surrounding football teams just in that particular area of Southeast Pennsylvania. And their rival was the Conshohocken Athletic Club, Pottstown, Lancaster. There are a lot of football clubs that were in Southeast Pennsylvania that tried to claim the supremacy of Eastern Pennsylvania football. And so the some townspeople who had a passion for football actually put together and founded the Union Club of Phoenixville. They were called the Big Red. And the Union Club established in 1907 and in its history never had a losing season. And it actually started in 1907. And so they would play a lot of the club football teams in and around eastern Pennsylvania, including some of the teams that came out of surrounding the Philadelphia area, such as Conshohocken and Germantown and Holmesburg. They played all those teams. But they actually were one of the best teams in eastern Pennsylvania back then. They never once had a losing record in their existence.
Wow, that is that's a pretty amazing fact there too. Yeah, athletic clubs were very big, as I know we learned in western Pennsylvania, the famous Allegheny Athletic Club against the Gannett Athletic Club. We had that very famous first professional game with Pudge Ethelfinger. So I guess maybe all across the state, maybe the whole region of the Northeast had a lot of these clubs that were playing football as it was becoming more popular.
Right, absolutely. And you know, what they were looking for was really local talent, and that's where they started to draw from. A lot of these teams, these club teams, drew from local talent. So it was a matter of pride for a lot of the teams when you drew local talent to play football. So if, for example, Phoenixville played Conshohocken, they actually, it was a big deal. It was about the pride of your town. And that's what some of the folks in Phoenixville wanted to make sure, is that they put together a good football team and could boast and be prideful of having the best team in eastern Pennsylvania. That was the goal. And that just continued. You know, I mean, I knew about that even when, by the time that I was born and grew up in that town, about the pride of football in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Wow, very, very interesting. Okay, so they're sort of a club team playing other club teams. What's sort of the progression that got them into maybe the semi-pro and professional levels of playing some of these bigger squads?
Well, in the first few decades of the 20th century, eastern Pennsylvania, Schuylkill Valley, being a hotbed of the gridiron, it allowed for places like Pottstown and Norristown and Conshohocken and, you know, some of the teams in the Philadelphia area to vie for being the best. But over time, basically the Union Club of Phoenixville consistently ranked as one of the most successful teams in the region. And for that reason, they started to get more and more where they felt as if that they could challenge some of the independent professional football teams. And they became an independent professional football team. Like I said, from 1907 until the end of their existence, Phoenixville never had a losing season, and they won 92% of their games over that course of time. They didn't play any games in 1919 because of the Spanish flu, so naturally their undefeated record kept intact, but however, they never had a losing season. And what really started to happen was in 1919, again, because Phoenixville was such a hotbed for football, there were other people in the town that created a rival football team called the Phoenix Athletic Club. And they started to sign a lot of the local talent, and they were challenging the Union Club of Phoenixville. And because Phoenixville did not play any games in 1919 because of the Spanish flu, it allowed for Phoenix Athletic Club to start signing some of the talent locally. And that was a real threat to the Union Club of Phoenixville, because since 1907, they were the mainstay of football. And so at that particular time, because of that rivalry, something had to be done. So in essence, what happened was you had 50 townspeople of Phoenixville come together after the 1919 season, and they made it an absolute point to say we need to put the best formidable football team on the field and to challenge some of the pro teams. And so what happened was the Phoenix Athletic Club and the Union Club of Phoenixville merged into one team. And that happened for the 1920 season. And that was really the pinnacle. The 1920 season was really the pinnacle of their success because of the fact that they were able to get the best talent in locally and beyond. They ended up having an undefeated season in 1920, going 11-0. And they played a lot of really good teams, not only in the local area, but they even played teams that were pre-NFL. One of the most important games of the 1920 season was against the Canton Bulldogs with Jim Thorpe.
Wow, that's big time for 1920. They were sort of the kingpins of professional football. I think most people would say a very famous player with Jim Thorpe on there, who sort of played his college ball down there in that area down in Carlisle. So that had to be a thrill for them. So what happened in this meeting with the Union Club team and the Canton Bulldogs?
Well, if I could just go back for just a little bit.
So, most certainly. Please do.
Yeah, before that. Because what had happened to that 1920 team, it was so full of talent that the future commissioner of the NFL, Bert Bell, who went to the University of Pennsylvania, he was looking to put together the Philadelphia Collegians to join the National Football League. But he couldn't lure anybody away from the Union Club of Phoenixville, because the Union Club of Phoenixville had a board of directors and their manager was named Leo Conway. And Leo Conway was the manager of the team. He basically did everything. He scheduled the games, scheduled the practices. He signed the players. That was his job. And he ended up being an important figure for the Union Club of Phoenixville and the future of professional football in the 1920s. And so when Bert Bell could not lure any of the players away from the Union Club of Phoenixville, he helped establish the Buffalo All-Americans, because some of the players that he wanted, he had to actually have that type of direction as far as being able to be part of the NFL. But the Union Club of Phoenixville in 1920 proved to be the best team of all the independent pro football teams, and even being able to challenge some of the teams pre-NFL, and especially the Union Club of Phoenixville's game against the Canton Bulldogs. And what happened on that game was, first of all, that was to take place. Leo Conway actually scheduled that with the Canton Bulldogs. That was to take place at the Baker Bowl in Philadelphia. The Baker Bowl was a stadium that actually was built for the Philadelphia Phillies in the 1800s. It only was meant to seat about 13,000 people. And yet, on December 11th, 1920, the Union Club of Phoenixville play the Canton Bulldogs in the Baker Bowl in Philadelphia. And they shattered at that time the local pro football attendance record, because 17,000 people showed up for that game. Now, even before that, you had people that were arriving before that Saturday game. They were coming in on Friday just to watch the Canton Bulldogs practice. And when they would come in and watch the Canton Bulldogs practice in Philadelphia, they were specifically looking to watch Jim Thorpe. And even though the Jim Thorpe was a little bit slower than what he was, in previous years, he could still punt the football. And, on that Friday before the game, Jim Thorpe was punting the football 50 yards, 40 and 50 yards. every kick. And the Union Club of Phoenixville, they wanted to make sure that nobody spotted in their practice, so they went to a little area where they couldn't get many people to watch them practice because they didn't want anybody spying on what they had ready for the Canton Bulldogs. So the game actually took place in the Baker Bowl in Philadelphia, and the Canton Bulldogs started out with a 7-0 lead. And yet what happened was is that basically Jim Thorpe got hurt, could not play in the second half, but the Big Red, Phoenixville's Big Red, with the lead of Heine Miller, who was the mainstay of the team, they ended up coming back in the second half and beating the Canton Bulldogs 14-7. That game was so anticipated that you had fans even coming down from Buffalo, New York, taking a train to Philadelphia to watch the Union Club of Phoenixville against the Canton Bulldogs. That's how big it was back then. It made all the papers in the Southeast Pennsylvania area. The Philadelphia papers actually promoted the game. But when you have people coming in from Buffalo, New York, as well as different parts of Pennsylvania for this game in which the Union Club of Phoenixville played the NFL Canton Bulldogs, it was a big deal.
Wow, yeah. Now, if I could, I just want to make sure we paint the picture here, because December 11th, 1920, that game is played. It was just a couple months earlier, September 17th, 1920, at that famous meeting at the Ralph Hayes Hutmobile Showroom, you know, owner of the Canton Bulldogs, that the APFA was formed, which 2 years later became the National Football League. And it was a big deal that had to be played on Saturdays in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania, until 1933, had the blue laws where even football played professionally couldn't be played on Sundays with those blue laws. So that's why you didn't see like the Pittsburgh Pirates or Steelers organization and the Eagles come until that 1933 when the blue laws were lifted. So that's why they had to play on a Saturday game and they were practicing on Friday. So just want to make sure we add that in there for the listeners. So very, very interesting indeed.
Yeah. Even, I mean, back then, the Pennsylvania Blue Laws made it so that if you played professional football on a Sunday, you could be arrested. Even when I was growing up, the Pennsylvania Blue Laws were still in place intact, that you could not buy any liquor on a Sunday. And I remember because they would have the liquor stores were called state stores in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and you could not buy liquor on a Sunday. So if it came upon the holidays, you know, whether it be Thanksgiving, Christmas, or New Year's, I remember, you know, my grandfather and my uncles used to actually make sure that they got all their party booze before Sunday because they knew that on Sunday they wouldn't be able to buy any liquor for their holiday parties if it happened to be on a Sunday. They couldn't do it, so they had to hurry up and run out and buy it before then.
Well, it's not much different now. I mean, the state stores are still there, but now they rebranded them as the wine and spirit stores, but they're still state-owned. And there's very few. I don't think that they're open on Sundays, but at least non-Pennsylvania, you can buy beer and wine coolers and things of that such at grocery stores. So that's just recent, the last like 5 years. So the blue laws are still somewhat in effect here. And bars can only be open if they have 75%, I think, of their business's food or some percentage like that. So, yeah, it's still kind of strict, but not like it was 100 years ago when the Union Club was playing.
And that was part of, you know, the history of the Union Club of Phoenixville and the NFL, because the owner of the Union Club of Phoenixville, well, he was the manager then, but he became the owner. He basically showed up at the NFL meetings trying to get the Union Club of Phoenixville into the NFL. The NFL owners at that time didn't want to deal with the Pennsylvania Blue Laws because the NFL games were played on Sunday. And that's why they were reluctant to add the Union Club of Phoenixville Big Red team into the NFL. They knew that they were good. They knew that that with the stars that were on the Union Club of Phoenixville, it would attract fans because, as you know, the National Football League at that time, the American Professional Football Association, were competing against baseball and college football. So they actually did need the stars to be on the field so they can attract fans. But, you know, because they play their games on Sunday, having a team that would only be able to play their games on Saturday because of the Pennsylvania Blue Laws was not something that seemed very attractive. But it turned out to be that it was a little bit of a problem because it was good for the players. If the players played on a Pennsylvania team, they knew that they would have to play on Saturday, not Sunday, and then they would take either a train to New York or a train to Ohio and play for National Football League teams so that they could get that extra paycheck. And that was something that, you know, was good for players who really wanted to have that extra paycheck. So that happened a lot in the 1920s.
Now, did they also, I know players from the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, I know Frankfurt's not too terribly far from Phoenixville, but I know some of the Frankfurt Yellow Jacket players would go play for the Buffalo All-Americans. Is that same with Phoenixville?
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, there were several players who played for the Buffalo All-Americans, and if I can name just a few.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, Jaime Miller was really the mainstay. He was the guy on the Union Club of Phoenixville. He was a University of Penn graduate, played on the Penn Quakers, and when he joined the Union Club of Phoenixville, he was basically the star. In the 1920s, he actually played, or 1920 season, he actually played 23 games during the course of that season because he'd play for Phoenixville on Saturday and then take a train up to Buffalo to play for the Buffalo All-Americans on Sunday.
Oh, boy, and the NFLPA is complaining now with playing 17 games. Boy, Heine Miller wouldn't like the NFLPA too much.
Exactly. And there were two other players, too. Lud Ray was another player who played on the Union Club of Phoenixville and then would take a train up to Buffalo and play for the Buffalo Americans on Sunday. Lud Ray's name is big because he played for the Union Club of Phoenixville, Big Red. But after his playing days were over, he was the co-founder with Bert Bell of the Philadelphia Eagles. So we have that direct connection. Phoenixville has that direct connection with the Philadelphia Eagles, because Lud Ray, who played for Phoenixville, along with Bert Bell, co-founded the Philadelphia Eagles. But he was another player that actually played for Phoenixville on Saturday and then would go up to Buffalo and play for the Buffalo All-Americans on Sunday. And that, again, that happened quite a bit in the NFL. And you had people like Stan Kofal, who played for Phoenixville on Saturday and then would travel to Ohio and play for the Cleveland Tigers on Sunday. And what became kind of a problem for the NFL owners, they didn't realize it at the time, that as these players were looking for extra paychecks, that a lot of their players would become tired. If they played on Saturday, sometimes the energy level wouldn't be quite up there like it was on Saturday, or especially during the course of a season in which someone like Heine Miller would play 23 games during the course of that season, and the owners were always worried about their players being tired. As a matter of fact, in 1921, Frank McNeil of the Buffalo All-Americans lodged a protest with the American Professional Football Association because of the fact that one of the independent pro football teams that was co-owned by Heine Miller and Leo Conway, they were going to play the Canton Bulldogs. And the problem for Frank McNeil was the fact that you had some of the players that were going to be tired. And so that was something that he lodged, and it forced the cancellation between the Quakers of that time and the Canton Bulldogs. And that caused a big stir because it really led, and some of the historians will agree to this, it led to basically the Buffalo All-Americans not being awarded the 1921 NFL championship. And the Chicago Staleys actually were awarded that championship. But that had to do with that particular issue at the time where, you know, you had players playing both for independent teams and the NFL teams and just basically just wearing out, being tired. And it caused, for some, the outcome of the games to change.
Wow, that's I can see where you'd be tired if you played on Saturday, had a real hard-fought game, and you know, some big competition, and you sleep on a train all night probably to get to Buffalo or Cleveland or wherever your route takes you. That's got to be kind of a long train ride, probably at least what would you say, 6-7 hours? I'll bet on a train.
Yes. For sure,
And you know, who knows if they were riding in the coach or not? They might have been just, you know, slipping on a boxcar and you know, sleeping their way there and then hopping off. Who knows? Because
exactly.
They weren't getting paid a good sum like the pro players do today. Wow, that's really interesting, and a lot of dedication is taken to want to play football. That's the love of the game there. That's for sure.
Exactly.
Now, in your preliminary notes, you also told of some other famous players, including a Pro Football Hall of Famer. That played on the 1920 team.
Right. And I'm really proud of this. Fritz Pollard, the first African-American coach of the National Football League, he played for the Union Club of Phoenix Hill. He was going to dental school in Philadelphia, which is why he came to Phoenix Hill to play for the Union Club of Phoenix Hill Big Red team. And he did that because he loved the game. He came from Brown University. He was very much a talent. When he played for the Phoenixville Big Red, he scored 5 touchdowns in 2 games. Now, he only played 2 games because in a game against Lancaster, he actually injured his shoulder. But that's how prolific he was as a runner when he scored 5 touchdowns in 2 games for the team. But he was someone that, you know, made an impact and is very much recognized as a member of the Union Club of Phoenix Hill Big Red team.
Now, did Pollard play in that 1920 game against Canton that you were talking about earlier, or was he injured for that game?
He was actually injured for that game, and what he was trying to do is he wanted to make sure that he was ready for the Akron Pro Games. And they were the ones, as you know, won the 1920 championship. They were actually awarded that championship at the league meetings on April 21 of that following year. But
wow! So they played the pros too. Wow! They were really playing the big boys from the APFA.
Absolutely. Lou Little was another famous tackle from the University of Pennsylvania, who actually was someone who was really recognized as one of the premier tackles in the league. He also played for the pre-NFL Frankfurt Yellow Jackets before they entered the NFL. As I mentioned before, Lud Ray was also from the University of Pennsylvania. Like I mentioned previously, he was a co-founder of the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, the question comes up is why so many people from the University of Pennsylvania played on the Union Club of Phoenixville. Well, the manager, Leo S. Conway, he was a University of Pennsylvania alum. So naturally, he was looking for players that came from his alma mater. And he found the talent around that time, mainly at the turn of the century, but even in the 1920s, the University of Pennsylvania Quakers were a national powerhouse. They had won national championships prior to that, and they were a national powerhouse. As a matter of fact, one of the big games in the 1924 season was against Illinois and Red Grange. And so Leo F. Conway really wanted a lot of Pennsylvania Quakers if possible, on the Union Club of Phoenixville.
Okay, that explains a lot when you were saying Burt Bell was trying to recruit, because we had Upton Bell, Burt Bell's son, who on the program a few months ago, and talking about his father, you know, being a player for the Penn Quakers, and so you know he has those ties there. So it's not just because they're in Eastern Pennsylvania, but they were all vying for their own school players, their alma mater players to come
play. Exactly.
Very interesting. It makes an interesting dynamic.
One of the other players that was played for the team was Swede Youngstrom, and he was a guard, a good size. He played for not only Union Club of Phoenixville, but he also played for the Buffalo Americans. He was one of those players that took a train up to Buffalo after the game on Saturday, took a train up to Buffalo and played for the Buffalo All-Americans on Sunday. He also played for the NFL champion Frankford Yellow Jackets in 1926. And so that was another talented player that Leo Conway was able to recruit. And Butch Spagna, he was another one who was actually on the Phoenix Athletic Club in 1919. And part of the merger, they got Butch Spagna to play for the Union Club of Phoenixville. And he ended up playing for the Philadelphia Quakers, that was founded by Red Grange and C.C. Pyle, and the Philadelphia Quakers won the 1926 American Football League Championship. So, and that was also owned by Leo F. Conway. And there's a little bit of a story that's behind that, but because of the pro football evolution, as it were, as far as teams and how they came about, there's a lot of connection to my hometown of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Wow. I'll tell you what, some of these names, those are some great football names. When you got guys, you know, named Fritz and, you know, Swede and Earl and Butch and, you know, Aki Anderson, I think you mentioned. Those are just some great names. It just strikes fear, a little bit of fear in me if I'm the opponent coming in to play them. And that's not even seeing them play, just their names. Wow. Very, very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, so go ahead.
No, I was just going to mention, you know, one of the things that happened after the 1920 season was the fact that Heinie Miller actually went to the board of directors of the Union Club of Phoenixville and said, hey, you know, we would like to field the same team in 1921. And the board of directors, even though that they had the undefeated 11-0 team could declare the mythical Eastern Pennsylvania Championship. And even after their defeat of the Canton Bulldogs, wanted to declare the championship of the United States of professional football, even though that was a little bit of a stretch, considering Canton wasn't as good as they were as they had been in the Ohio League. The fact is that the board of directors decide to go cheaper for the 1921 season. So they wanted to basically hire local players, you know, at a less costly pay for the players. And so basically Heinie Miller and Leo S. Conway took most of the talented players that they had on the Union Club of Phoenixville and formed the Union Quakers of Philadelphia and moved the team to Philadelphia. And even though that the Union Club of Phoenixville played their season in 1921, they only played 7 games. They went 5-2. They still had a winning record, but it was the Union Quakers of Philadelphia that were playing a lot of the NFL teams at that time. And so most of the players from the Union Quakers of Philadelphia followed Heinie Miller and Leo Conway to Philadelphia. And because they only played one season, Leo Conway ended up popping up as the owner of the Philadelphia Quakers of Red Grange's American Football League because he couldn't get his team into the NFL. So he decided to join Red Grange and C.C. Pyle's AFL, and he owned the Philadelphia Quakers. And lo and behold, some of the players that he had that were on the Phoenixville team and the Union Quakers of Philadelphia ended up being the AFL champions of 1926. And at that particular time, they actually challenged the NFL champion Frankfurt Yellow Jackets to see which team would be the best team between the AFL and the NFL, and especially the Championship of Philadelphia, which, you know, for a lot of football fans of Pennsylvania, that was more important. But the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets declined to play the Philadelphia Quakers, and so Leo Conway arranged for a game between the Philadelphia Quakers, the champions of the AFL, and the New York Giants. And they played that game in the Polo Grounds in a very snowy day in December 1926 and got blown out by the New York Giants 31-0. So even at that time, there was a question whether the AFL was as good as any team in the NFL, and that question was settled. I think it would have been really cool for the Philadelphia Quakers to play the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, since Frankfurt was a section of Philadelphia, and to have that NFL-AFL championship game as such. But it would have been cool.
Yeah, that very, very interesting. So the original AFL, Grange and C.C. Pyle created, they would add an AFL-NFL matchup, very similar to Super Bowl I, which I think was the third rendition of the AFL. I think there was a second one in there somewhere in the 1940s, 1950s. So, wow, extremely interesting. I didn't realize that they took that team and made them into the Philadelphia Quakers team. Extremely interesting.
And that's, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, kind of a connection for football historians that live in and around Phoenixville because of the fact that, you know, again, you had the connection between Phoenixville, and because of Leo Conway owning the team, owning the Philadelphia Quakers of the AFL, you had that connection between some players that played in Phoenixville, played for the NFL champion Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, and then you had a player who played for Phoenixville who ended up co-founding the Philadelphia Eagles. So there's so much connection between my home team and the history, the early history of pro football teams of the NFL and then the AFL of 1926, which, you know, I'm very proud of. It's one of the reasons why I became so almost fanatical about the history of pro football, because of the connections of just exactly where I was born and raised.
Well, I can definitely understand your passion with those, some as intriguing stories as these are. Now, I mean, the other connection is I'm assuming when the original AFL of Grange and C.C. Pyle sort of dissolved, did many of those players end up going and playing for Frankfurt then?
There were a couple that actually did go and play for Frankfurt. They also went to other teams in the NFL. In 1927, 1928, even up to 1931, that they decided to rejoin the NFL. And as you know, Red Grange went back to the NFL. And he was still with the New York Yankees and then rejoined the Chicago Bears in the 1929 season, after he got injured, in 1927, then had to recover. But a lot of players that were playing in the AFL went back to the NFL to play.
Yeah, I was just making that connection because I know when Upton Bell was on, he told of how his father, Burt Bell, and his mother, who was a vaudeville star and silent movie star and Broadway star, Frances Upton, you know, very famous. She had, you know, some cash from being famous. Burt Bell suffered some big losses in the Great Depression and stock market crash. But the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets went bankrupt, and the Bell family purchased them at the bankruptcy court and then named them the Eagles. So you have that whole connection of Phoenixville, you know, and the Penn Quakers sort of staying in that area and turning into the modern day Philadelphia Eagles. That's very interesting.
I actually have a lot of respect for Burt Bell and what he meant to the NFL. And the fact that he actually came to Phoenixville to try to lure players and to get players to join his team that he tried to create. He recognized talent when he saw it. And the fact that, you know, he actually saw talent in Phoenixville means a lot to me. What he did for the NFL even meant more to me because of the fact that he helped evolve the NFL. You know, he was one that actually did the schedule by hand in the time that he was a commissioner. And I like the fact that, you know, I heard some stories. I attended Pete Rozelle's memorial service in Beverly Hills in 1997. And there were some of the older players that were telling me that, you know, they could actually call the NFL office in Philadelphia when it was in Philadelphia at the time. And Bert Bell would actually pick up the phone and say, how can I help you? You know, and I thought that was pretty cool. That was pretty cool to hear stories like that. Bert Bell was wonderful. He really was.
Yeah, Upton would tell us stories. Of course, that his father, Bert Bell's father, John C. Bell, I mean, he was on the original football rules committee with Walter Camp. And that's how deep that family goes into football. It's amazing. Bert Bell would take phone calls at home on their home phone, Upton said he remembered, because their home was at the hotel that John C. Bell, his father, owned. And all of the Eagles players would live there with the Bell family. And that's where they housed them. And so Upton's babysitters were, you know, some of the Eagles players. But he said his father would constantly be taking, phone calls when he was with the Eagles. Then when he was a commissioner, of course, he'd be taking league calls at home and, also at the office. So, yeah, very interesting. And Bert Bell was very tied into the NFL, and that's why he was so successful and helped the league succeed. So just by him caring and, you know, giving a darn about it, he really put some effort in there. So, yeah, kudos to him. His only bad thing is when he merged with my team during World War II, part owner and coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and they didn't do so good then, so we won't talk about that.
Well, it was, you know, I often hear about, you know, players that at the time, you know, their sons or their descendants will tell me that, you know, that was a lean time in the 1940s because all the men who were really talented, they were off to war fighting for the United States of America in World War II, so it was kind of lean for a lot of people in sports at that particular time, you know.
Yeah, so. And rightly so. Their patriotism, you know, we thank them, or, you know, we might not be speaking English here having this conversation today. So, you know, so exactly. We appreciate the sacrifices that all those folks did, football players and non-football players that went and served our country. So, definitely.
One of the things that I did do, which why Phoenixville matters to me. So in 2005, when Fritz Pollard actually was inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I actually made that trip to Canton, Ohio to see that induction. And to be honest with you, before that, I literally wrote to every Pro Football Hall of Fame writer who was a Hall of Fame voter to try to lobby Fritz Pollard to be elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, including Michael Wilbon, pardon the interruption. And because Fritz Pollard was from Chicago, I kind of threw that in there. I said, Michael, you're from Chicago. Fritz Pollard's from Chicago. Shouldn't that be a reason to vote him in the Pro Football
Hall of Fame? Wow, kudos to you for that. Wow, that's quite an undertaking.
Yeah, but, you know, to me, it was well overdue. Fritz Pollard was just someone who just had amazing talent, endured so much with what was happening, you know, in our country at that particular time when it came down to sports with all the racial stuff going on. But, you know, he was very worthy. And I got the chance to meet his family. You know, I met his young daughter at that time, his youngest daughter and his grandchildren. And, you know, to me, that was quite an honor. You know, and I actually told them, you know, about their father and grandfather playing for Phoenixville at the time. And I told them that's why I was there. I was there for Fritz Pollard.
Wow. You, sir, are definitely the a great person for preserving football history, and you know, even those individual players and their importance. I mean, I think, you know, Fritz Pollard, I don't know that many people had even heard of him, you know, 5 years ago, unless you were really into football history. But now he's really become quite the name, you know, getting up there with the names of Red Grange and Jim Thorpe and others. You know, he's becoming that popular from 100 years ago. So it's folks like you that have done that. So we thank you for that.
No, thank you very much. I felt honored to, at that time on that same trip, I felt honored that I met Virginia Hallis McCaskey. And she was off in a little corner and she was surrounded by, you know, quite a few people, but I had to introduce myself because I wanted to meet the woman who has watched more pro football games than any human in history on earth.
Yeah.
Because when you think about it, she has.
Yeah. And of course, Mrs. McCaskey is the daughter of George Hallis, who is the sort of the founder of the Chicago Bears. Originally played Decatur Staleys, went to the Chicago Staleys, and the Chicago Bears owner, coach, player, just about everything. So that is important. And yeah, she has watched a lot of football games. Okay. Now, I guess before we digress too much, I want to make sure we get back to topic here. Okay. So the 1921 Union Club team went 5-2. With many of their players from 1920 going to the Quakers team in Philadelphia in the AFL. So what happened to the Union Club of Phoenixville after that?
They basically folded. Because they did not have the stars that they had, the local talent was one in which they could not be able to attract enough people, both either at home or on the road, to be able to sustain, because in all honesty, they were actually competing against the Union Quakers of Philadelphia in 1921. Before that, because the Union Quakers of Phoenixville was so good, they actually were the hope of that entire area. That's why they played a lot of their home games at the Baker Bowl in Philadelphia. They had their own home field called Union Field, but most of their home games were played in Philadelphia, because Leo S. Conway was able to get a lease at the Baker Bowl. He certainly attracted a lot of fans to the Baker Bowl with the games that he would schedule. But without Leo Conway, without being able to get the profits needed, basically the Union Club of Phoenixville folded after the 1921 season.
Ah, okay. But what a legacy that they left and never had a losing season. You said, wow, that is
right.
Truly, truly interesting. And now you have all this great research. You have all this great history that you shared with us. Are you going to be writing a book? Have any plans for that, or you know, helping somebody co-author a book? Because this story is one that needs to be told, my friend. This is truly interesting.
Well, I hope that something will really come of it. I have been recently asked to write an article for the Coffin Corner, the magazine of the Professional Football Researchers Association. So I will be doing that specifically on the Union Club of Phoenixville. And I'm hoping that...
I can't wait for that.
Yeah. I'm hoping for... something even bigger to be able to do because of the connection between the Union Club of Phoenixville and the Philadelphia Quakers, and especially the Philadelphia Eagles. How that all came about, as far as the history of professional football in the region. Those players did play in the NFL, and they attracted fans. Not like quite like Red Grange did when he came in the NFL, but they did attract fans. They were names at that particular time, certainly in Southeast Pennsylvania. Hymie Miller was a big name. He was a big name in Southeast Pennsylvania, in Phoenixville itself, in Philadelphia. And when he played for the Buffalo All-Americans, this is why in the Phoenixville Canton Bulldogs game of December 1920, you had fans taking trains from Buffalo to come down and see Hynie Miller, Lud Ray, and some of the other players that played on both Phoenixville and Buffalo, but they were stars that attracted fans. And I'm grateful that they played in my hometown.
Well, Scott, you know, we really appreciate you coming on here. We appreciate your passion of preserving the memories and the history of this very interesting team that had so much to do with the fabric of pro football as what we know it right now and their contributions. And we thank you for doing all this due diligence and bringing and shedding light to them, both to, you know, the PFRA and the, you know, here on Pigskin Dispatch and everything else that you're going to do with that. And, you know, I thank you for coming on and spending the time with us. And, you know, I wish you good luck here in telling that story. So anything we can do to help you, please let us know.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you for allowing me to come on your show and to be able to tell this story. And I just felt invigorated when you invited me to do so. And I'm excited that, you know, I was able to talk about this because it's not really well known, but I enjoy talking about it. And I enjoy the being able to have that connection between my hometown and the NFL.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcast, is found right here on the Sports History Network.